when you're raising money, you're selling securities. That's why securities laws exist. That's why the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, it's because even though you may not think of it as a security because you're just buying real estate, what you're really giving the investor is a piece of the company, right? A 1% interest, a 2%. You're basically selling them a piece of the LLC or the LP, whatever. That's what you're selling. That's what you're giving the investor in exchange for cash.
Are you tired of trying to keep ahead in the rat race, only to have so much of your hard-earned money going to the tax collector? Equity doesn't pay the bills. Retirement savings don't pay you now, and there are only 24 hours in a day to work. The only solution is passive income that pays you 24/7 now, not 40 years from now. From vetted investment opportunities to tax saving strategies, let John guide you through all the confusion and take control of your financial life in pursuit of financial freedom. So sit back, relax, and welcome to the Wealth and Freedom Nexus.
Hey, welcome back to another great episode of the WFN podcast, Wealth and Freedom Nexus. As always, be sure to rate, review, subscribe, and share across your network so that more like-minded people can find this podcast and learn how to increase their wealth through passive income and increase their freedom. Now, this episode has actually been a long time coming. I wanted to do a deep dive into some of the syndicator phrases or terms you might have heard, maybe online or from other podcasts or, you know, bigger pockets, just to name a few. You know, 506C, 506B, Regulation A, Regulation A plus. You know, what are they? What do they all mean? What does it mean to you as an investor? When I started my investment journey back in 2014, I got really discouraged and actually still continue to get discouraged when there are investment opportunities that I cannot or could not participate in. So with this episode, I was able to bring on a syndication attorney that I met in Belize from 2021. You probably guessed it. Summit on Sand by the Real Estate Guys. Great event. Definitely highly encourage everyone to at least attend once. It's very life-changing. You network with a lot of people. You learn a lot. And, you know, especially with the changing times that we're in, any information that can help you, you know, give you a slight edge when it comes to investing and protecting your money, I think is, you know, all the better. So with this, this attorney, after numerous reschedulings, the third time was the charm, and happy to finally bring on Mauricio Raoul, who's one of the nation's leading attorneys specializing in real estate syndication. And you might have heard him too. He does several live Q&As, which I'll have a link to in the show notes, that he does every Tuesdays. Been on the Real Estate Guys radio show podcast numerous times. And like I said, I saw him in Belize back in 2021. Doing numerous presentations, breakdowns as far as syndications, the tax treatments, so on and so forth. Now, just so you know, I'm not an attorney, I'm not a CPA or anything like that, but I'll just kind of speak very high level here. Some, I'll just say, platforms, you know, maybe you've seen on my website of investment opportunities, some of them can accept anyone, or maybe what's called sophisticated investors, like Ignite Funding, which I had on last month with Howard, brought on to have my listeners learn more about Ignite Funding and Trust Deeds. So this would be an example, or Ignite Funding is an example of a platform that can take on non-accredited investors that are still seeking a good return and don't necessarily have to have a high barrier of entry or high amount of money to put in to invest. Now, like I said, you know, that's with Ignite Funding, but there's others that can only take accredited investors. And contrary to what many people think, and I thought this for a number of years, it is not the dollar amount that determines if you can invest or not. Just, you know, in my own research and my own dealings, networking, whatever, I've seen as low as $1,000, which I think, you know, probably anyone listening to this, you know, probably has $1,000 available, even in $1,000 in their retirement account. If they wanted to self-direct a retirement account, you know, $1,000 isn't a lot to come up with nowadays, but you had to be accredited. And on the flip side, I've seen as high as $200,000, which is much more than I can afford to put in one investment. And I'm quite certain it's probably the same boat for many of you out there listening. It was as high as $200,000, but you did not have to be accredited. And then, of course, everything in between, you know, $50,000, $75,000, $25,000. That's just the spread I've seen from $1,000 to $200,000. And on the $1,000 end, you did have to be accredited. $200,000, you did. It just shows how ridiculous the industry seems and how confusing it can be. And I'm just going to say, you know, blame the SEC or the Securities and Exchange Commission, because they're out to protect you. I want to make sure that you, you know, don't lose any of your money and make sure that this is only available for the smart people. Why people could still, you know, take out loans and, you know, plunk $30,000 into Dogecoin or a meme stock and go belly up to the tune of $90,000, but they can't invest in the, you know, platform that, I don't know, invest in real estate where they're first lien position and they only have to do $1,000. Why the SEC says you can do this and you can't do this, I'll never understand. But for now, I'm just, you know, trying to follow the rules and learn the rules as best I can and pass along what I've learned to all my listeners. So here's just a quick rundown of two of the most popular terms you've probably seen when it comes to syndications, when it comes to funds, and that is 506B, B as in boy, versus 506C, C as in cat. And I'll just give a quick rundown here. So I always kind of joke 506C means see you later because I'm not an accredited investor. And 506B is I'll be right back with my money. That's just my little tidbit that I kind of came up with that I knew if I could invest in the platform or not. A lot of times when I would have phone calls or Zoom calls with a syndicator or investment platform, I just first flat out say, hey, are you 506B or 506C? And if they were 506C, I didn't want to waste any of their time. I you know, advise everyone to ask that question too, because if it's not something you can invest in, you know, it's not a benefit to anyone to waste time of, yeah, tell me everything about this investment, even though I can't invest in it. So 506C versus 506B comes to if you're accredited or not. So what is an accredited investor, you might be asking. So per the SEC's definition, an accredited investor has a net worth of $1 million or more, not including your primary resident. Or if you're single, it's $200,000 adjusted gross income. Or if you're married filing jointly, $300,000 a year adjusted gross income. And typically you have to show that you've done this for at least the last 2 years with a, I remember the legal language, but it's like reasonable expectation that you will make that same amount following year or, I don't know, perpetuity or whatever the case may be. Generally, that's to throw out the people of, you know, they had a high commission sales job 1 year, or they won the lottery, or they, you know, had a huge capital gains tax. And maybe on paper, it's like, yeah, I made $200,000 because I sold my Tesla stock and I've owned it since it first IPO'd or something like that. So they do have very strict guidelines in there. You know, a lot of times you'll hear of, you know, making $200,000 or $300,000. And again, that is adjusted gross income or AGI. And, you know, simple terms, not talking like a CPA, that is basically what you show the IRS that, I made X number of dollars last year. That's after you take into account your standard deductions, your deductions from your, you know, whatever, 401k contributions or healthcare plan savings, wherever the case may be. You may gross over $300,000 from your investments, but after expenses, and especially depreciation, which is one of my favorite aspects of real estate, you might show a zero income going to Uncle Sam, which is perfectly fine. But again, it comes down to what is your adjusted gross income. And usually you'll see a lot of high paid professionals meet this criteria, you know, your lawyers, your doctors, small business owners, sole proprietorships, where the bulk of their money is from their W-2, their commissions, whatever the case may be. So they qualify. And I found in my, you know, my experience and a lot of others, usually the net worth is just a little bit easier to crack, especially since for whatever reason, again, don't ask me to explain what the SEC is doing. You probably noticed if you're single, income level of verification is 200,000. If you're married filing jointly, well, then it has to be 300,000. Well, that's a 50% jump. But if you're married filing jointly, the net worth requirement does not jump to 1.5 million. It just stays at 1 million for whatever the reason is, you know, who knows. So that's kind of a quick little rundown of accredited investor versus non-accredited investor. Now for 506B, a syndicator can usually take up to 95 non-accredited investors, but they can't advertise their offering. They can't go on Facebook. They can't send out mailers or text messages or emails or whatever. And it does seem to kind of create one hell of a paradox. It's like, well, I have this syndication. It's a 506B. I want to get the word out. I want to take on investors, but I can't advertise. So how do you get the word out? And just, again, high level basically just comes down to, again, you might have heard the old saying, it's not what you know, it's who you know. And from networking, from rubbing shoulders or rubbing elbows, if you will, from other people in the space. And then you start to know people and establish a pre-existing relationship. That is simply what opens up the doors to 506B opportunities where they weren't advertised to you. You just learned about them through a pre-existing relationship, so to speak. 506C, on the contrary, they can only take accredited investors. They will not take non-accredited investors. And to be fair, on their end, there's a lot less paperwork that has to be filed, a lot less due diligence to show that, hey, SEC director, I did my due diligence and proved these 35 people are sophisticated investors and these people are accredited investors or whatever the mix is. Or, you know, I've even just kind of passed the buck. It's like, hey, they need to come to me and show that they are an accredited investor. And usually that comes from a, you know, signing of a letter from a CPA or attorney, or even from a similar to like a background check to see if John Rickgarn or John Smith or whoever is an accredited investor. And this is something we'll kind of go into a little bit more detail with my interview today. So, but 506Cs, they can advertise. If you see someone, you know, Facebook or you're getting emails, if it doesn't flat out say on the bottom for accredited investors only, technically, or, you know, more than likely, I should say, it's probably only available for accredited investors because you're seeing advertisements for it. And then there is a few exceptions, what's called Regulation A, kind of an interesting background on that. And again, you'll have to tune into the rest of this podcast as far as where Regulation A fits into the whole syndication space, if you will. So that's kind of the quick down and dirty to figure out if you are an accredited investor or not. Basically, it's a litmus test of your net worth or your income or your joint income if you are married and filing jointly. There are some other avenues that the SEC has opened up where you can take, you know, Series 7, your Series 82, your Series 65 test. These are basically just state-run exams that prove you know how to do math, you know investment terminology, and you're qualified to give financial advice. So if you see someone that's a licensed financial advisor or a licensed stockbroker, for instance, generally speaking, they would have had to take one, if not all, and maybe some additional test that basically proves, yep, this person knows what they're talking about. Yep, they can give financial advice. And since they are obviously well-educated, that was kind of one of the exceptions that they put into play per the SEC of what they would allow accreditation via exams essentially versus wait until you had so much money or you made so much more money. I've actually debated about getting my Series 7 and taking some of those tests as well, not only to kind of shortcut the accreditation status, but I don't think there's a week going by that people don't text me. It's like, hey, what would you invest in? Can you invest my money? Can you do this? Can you do that? It's like, hey, I'm just here for financial education. I'm just passing on all the knowledge that I've learned over the last 8 years and continue to learn and hoping to shortcut it. But, you know, I have kicked around, starting a wealth advisory firm or wealth coaching firm of some sort. We'll see if 2023 comes about with that or if that comes to fruition. And one final note I did want to mention, just in my interview here with Mauricio Raul, he did finally put to bed on the qualifying of the net worth litmus test. It's a question I've had for the last 2 years. And I'm not going to name names, but there's actually a well-known person in the real estate space that has been incorrectly defining an accredited investor. I will just say this person basically states, oh, it's the equity in your home, not the value of your home, as far as what meets the accreditation standard. So small, you know, round numbers, you have a $1.2 million net worth. Your house is worth $200,000. Subtract that out. Still at a $1 million minus your primary residence. Hey, you're an accredited. Some, and there's more than one individual, I should say. Some have kind of played this up where, you know, let's just say you have a $1.1 million total net worth, including your primary residence. And let's just use the same numbers again. It's a house that's worth $200,000. Again, your primary home. You have a 50% mortgage on it, or $100,000, 50% loan to value, $200,000 home, $100,000 in equity, $100,000 is tied out by debt. So your equity in your primary residence is $100,000. And again, incorrectly, there's been some that have said, well, you just take your net worth of $1.1 million, subtract your equity in your primary home of $100,000. Hey, you're still at $1 million. You're an accredited investor. Mauricio put that one to bed and kind of explained a little bit more into detail. So again, just be sure you stick around and hear for all that. And like I said, the SEC is pretty well clear cut on this. You know, this is a, you know, here we are in late 2022. Since 1982, when all these exemptions, the 506B, the 506C were put in, $1 million is not the same as it once was. In fact, Mauricio throws out basically what $1 million from 1982 is what that's worth now. So there has been a number of discussions, some talks, some politicians, think tanks, whatnot, that are trying to redefine what an accredited investor will be. They'll do something different with the qualifications. Maybe they'll raise up the income and or net worth threshold. You know, who knows? It's hard to say what's going to be going on. But like I said, these are the rules as they are late 2022, depending on when you're listening to this. I myself actually hope to be accredited by the end of 2023, even without doing an exam, just hoping that our should fall into place that I will meet this by net worth litmus test. And I hope everyone listening to this pursues this as well, because when you do hit that accredited status, it is, you know, nice feather in your cap, if you will, but it does open up the door to many, many, many other investment opportunities out there. Again, that can be advertised, many times can be greater returns, and can just really compound your wealth after that. Finally, as we round out 2022, since this is one of the last episodes here for the year, I just want to thank everyone again for your support. This podcast has really taken off in the last year and already have episodes banked into March of next year. It's hard to believe I've had quite the support, not only for my listeners, but also guests coming on. Some reach out to me. It's like, hey, I'd love to be on your show. And others I reach out to and say, hey, would you mind being a guest to talk about, you know, asset protection or this investment platform or whatever? And more times often than not, they're more than willing to come on. So if you haven't subscribed yet, be sure to, as I still have three great episodes coming out before the end of the year. Next week, we'll have a returning guest, Wagner Nolasco from Build to Rent Direct, how the Florida real estate market is doing for investors, as well as some updates. You know, might have heard the news about Hurricane Ian, the destruction of, you know, what that storm, that hurricane did to Florida, and how Build to Rent's portfolio has lasted, or how they've essentially weathered that storm, so to speak. For that, we'll have another guest that I networked with, and have to do a big shout out to Yona Weiss, who's coming back on again in January. I met with this individual who came on to talk about, a very unique investment. I'll just put it that way. I myself was very skeptical when I heard this, but the more and more I listened, more I heard about it, more I talked to other investors that were invested in this, I thought, you know, this is definitely worth a look. Now, this is only available to accredited investors, but does provide high cash flow and the best part, near or possibly zero tax liability, just the way the tax laws favor this. So I'll just kind of leave that out. Hopefully that's a little bit of a teaser to get you to subscribe and tune in for the rest of the year with the upcoming podcasts. And finally, we'll finish up the year. I was having a hard time deciding what should I do for the last podcast of the year. And after thinking about a while, actually going to have an interview with a businessman. Networked him with him on the Summit at Sand in Belize. He actually relocated his business and his personal residence. And this is to a place in the U.S. where he was able to lower his tax liability down to 4%. And this is within the U.S. You can kind of call it a quasi-country spotlight, if you will, because this is not another country, but it is a different jurisdiction or territory, I'll say. And for those of you that followed me for quite some time, have known me for many years, I'll just give a little hint. My wife and I have visited this area 3 times ourselves. Personally love the area. And one of those visits was actually to celebrate New Year's Eve. So, and stayed there throughout the new year. So felt, well, this will be the perfect episode to close out 2022 with episode 63 that will come for the last Wednesday of 2022. So with that, I've rambled on and talked long enough. So we'll get in our interview with Mauricio after a word from our sponsors, ECI Development. Have you ever wanted to invest like the wealthy and how the 1% do, but think it's out of reach for you? Do you desire a more abundant lifestyle, but think you can't afford it? If so, check out ECI Development. With over 20 years of international real estate experience, Mike Cobb and his team can help you truly diversify your portfolio and lifestyle. How about benefiting from a generational investment that can 10x your wealth or more with a teak hardwood parcel in Panama or Nicaragua? Maybe it'll even lead to residency options in the future. Perhaps you'd be interested in a beachfront condo for under $250,000, enjoying the beautiful sunsets off the Pacific Ocean. Maybe an eco-friendly tiny home for around $100,000. ECI's team can even help you get financing for these investments. To learn more, check out the show notes or go to wealthandfreedomnexus.com/ECI. Mauricio, thanks for coming back on, and I hope all is well since we saw each other at the Summit on Sand in 2021.
I know, that's great to see you too. Yeah, I missed last year, but the 2021 was awesome, and I'm sure the last one was just as good, if not better. It usually gets better every year, so I'm looking forward to next year.
Yeah, no, I kind of skipped out too. I was like, well, no, I've been to Belize. It was kind of a bucket list item. And oh yeah, I got a newborn at home. So, you know, family takes precedence. Right. Well, as I kind of alluded into the intro, obviously, you know, I've heard you speak, and obviously we met in person over a year ago. And I know you've kind of dived into the syndication space, you know, helping, you know, capital raisers. I think you put it stand up SEC jail, so to speak, and maybe high level. And I think myself and many other investors have heard these, you know, terms, so to speak, you know, Regulation A, 506B, 506C, et cetera, et cetera. First, maybe you want to tell us just how you got into this space or what attracted you to it, I should say.
Yeah, sure. And by the way, there is no SEC jail. It's just the regular jail.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Look, I kind of stumbled upon it, right? So when I left the law firm, when I left law school, I went to work for a law firm. I did a lot of securities work back then. I'm a securities attorney, right? So I was representing a lot of the big brokerage houses back then, JP Morgan, Merrill Lynch, American Express, Goldman Sachs, or whatever. But I was a defense attorney. We did litigation. So when they got sued, that's when we would get called in and I would start the defense and, you know, do all the, you know, depositions and motions and trial and all that kind of, even appellate work. I did a little bit of appellate work. And then when I decided to leave the firm, I went to work for the real estate guys. They had as their general counsel in-house. They've got a development company and they're obviously not just podcasters. They're actually real estate investors, really good ones.
Right.
And so they were doing a lot of syndication. So that's really where I started cutting my teeth. First as general counsel, I was sort of the liaison between the guys and the securities attorney that they currently had at the time. And then over time, it's just, I just kind of took that over. And then when I left them and started my own firm, naturally I started doing syndications as well. But it really wasn't until my daughter was born, right around when my daughter was born, which was 2016 or 17. She's six, whatever that math turns out to be.
2016, I think. So.
That I just realized I was, you know, look, when you start a law firm, you do whatever puts food on the table, right? Yep. That's what I was doing to begin with. And then I narrowed it down as I got my practice grew to both syndication and asset protection. So I'm also asset protection attorney. But then as I started looking at the numbers, I just realized, look, I'm spending most of my time doing the asset protection, but it only generates a small amount of revenue. I'm doing a little bit of syndication, but it's generating most of my revenue. Let's just focus all in on syndication. And I guess I got super lucky. because, you know, back then, 2016, yeah, there was syndications, but it really has been like a boom from probably before 16, but it's really been a syndication boom. The amount of people that are actually raising capital today is, I don't know if there's ever been a time in history where more people, at least the mom and pops, is always going to be the Goldman Sachs and the Black Rocks of the world. But I think from a mom and pop and people, you know, a lot of my clients are still W-2 employees and they do this on the side. A lot of clients started as W-2, they now retired and do this full time. And so I just, you know, I got fortunate, and especially since COVID too, because COVID, everything kind of shut down for about six to 8 months on the syndication world. But again, since then, you know, it's just been crazy. Like just, you know, with everything that's going on, it's been a fun ride, to say the least.
Cool. Interesting. So now, you know, I kind of, you know, mentioned some of these earlier than also in the intro, but, you know, I myself was really confused back in, you know, 2015, 2016, when I really started learning, you know, what exactly is a syndication. And then I saw, you know, 506B, 506C, Reg A, and maybe there's some other ones out there that I'm not even aware of. Could you maybe in, you know, non-legalese per se, exactly explain what exactly are all these different flavors of syndications?
Yeah, of course. I mean, as you know, they, you know, I'm generally considered one of the few attorneys that actually speaks English. So that's
okay. All right.
turn these. Look, it's really not that complicated from a structural standpoint. I think when you hear it this way, it's going to make sense. You are, when you're raising money, you're selling securities. That's why securities laws exist. That's why the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, it's because even though you may not think of it as a security because you're just buying real estate, what you're really giving the investor is a piece of the company, right? A 1% interest, a 2%. You're basically selling them a piece of the LLC or the LP, whatever. That's what you're selling. That's what you're giving the investor in exchange for cash, right? Investor gives you $50,000. You give them a 1.2% ownership interest or whatever it looks like. Maybe it's a note, but basically you're selling securities, right?
Okay.
And all you need to understand is that once you're in the business of selling securities, it's a highly regulated space.
Okay. Right?
And the rule states that if you're selling securities, so John, when you're selling your securities, you either have to register that security with the SEC, which is the last thing we want to do. No, nobody, but at least in our world, we don't want to register.
Gotcha.
Or we have to find an exemption to registration.
Okay.
Or it's illegal. It's that simple, right? You register, you find an exemption, or it's illegal. And again, we don't want to register because it takes 18 months, 20 months. You don't have time. Plus it costs a lot of money. So you don't want to go that route. But that's basically going public, right? Unless you want to go public when you just start, you're not going to go public. And you obviously don't want to do anything illegal or non-compliant. So you're looking for exemptions, right? And that's where I live. I live in the exemption world. And what you just rattled off are just the most popular exemptions. I mean, by far, 95% of the people are going to use either a 506B or a 506C exemption. Those are just two of the most popular exemptions. And then over the last few years, Reg A, really Reg A Plus, got amended, and it's become a little bit more, or actually a lot more appealing versus if you go back before this new rule change 5 years ago or whenever it came out, 7 years ago, time flies when you're having fun, you'll realize that Reg A, there was like five Reg A's done in the entire country per year. I mean, nobody did Reg A's. Then the rule changed. And they're like, oh, okay, now Reg A starts to make a little bit more sense. But by far, the ones you're going to hear the most is probably a 506B.
Sure.
Which is the original exemption that everybody used. And then, you know, after the last great financial crisis, they added this 506C, which allows, even though it's still a private offering because you're not going public, it does allow for advertising. So it's a little bit of a misnomer because it's a private offering, but you can advertise to the general public. So it's a little bit weird. But even between let's break down the numbers, and this is why you hear it all the time. Between 95% of all exemptions are one of those three. 93% of them are going to be either 506B, 506C. That's the vast majority. You're always going to hear those. And then between those, 92% are going to be Bs and only about 8% are going to be Cs.
So
506B is by far the most common. That's why you typically will hear 506B, but you may hear a 506C as well. And those all, if you ever hear another term, and this is as technical as we're ever going to get today, but those 506B and 506C, the two most common exemption, fall under the umbrella of Reg D as in David. We have Reg A, which is its own animal, Reg D, which has those two exemptions. And there's a Reg S for international. There's a bunch. You mentioned there's probably another bunch of others. There's a bunch of other exemptions, but very few people use them.
Gotcha. Okay. So 506C, 506B, you know, 90 plus percent, that's where most of them are. And lot of it comes to accredited investor, not accredited. You can advertise, you can't advertise, you're limited to advertising and so forth.
Yeah, the key to those three, and the reason those are the most popular, is because they what we call preempt state law. So we don't worry about the states. Can you imagine if you were raising money from investors from eight different states?
Oh boy.
Can you imagine having to go hire attorneys in those eight states, make sure we're not violating their statutes,
Sure
our structure fits into those eight states plus the federal? I mean, it'd be a nightmare. And so these are nice because once we comply at the federal level, we don't have to worry about the state statutes, other than we still have the anti-fraud provision. So obviously, if you're defrauding investors and you're doing some stuff like that, they're not going to have. But I don't have to worry about, you know, am I limited to 35? You know, can you imagine you're limited to 35, but California limits you to 12 and 15? I mean, it would just be a nightmare. So that's why they're so popular.
Or then maybe you say, like, well, this one investor, we really want them. Can you now spend 6 months and one day in Montana so we can get 35?
Right.
One 35. And then the rest of the time you're in California. And yeah, I could just see that being a mess.
That's why those are the three most popular, because they preempt. And that's the issue with Reg A. In the old days, it didn't preempt. So that's why it was very, very rarely used. Even if you did a Reg A, you'd have to still comply. And look, if you were doing it in one or two states, maybe that's not a problem. But most Reg A's, you know, they're $50 million and now they're up to 75.
Okay.
20 back then, you know, you may have six or seven different states.
Okay. So is there what's the big difference between like Reg A versus the 506 flavors? Or
So the Reg A, so the main difference with Reg A is actually what we call sort of a mini IPO or an IPO light, people call it. So it's a mini registration. So the main difference is with the Reg A, you actually have to run it through the SEC.
Okay.
You follow the SEC and you get it approved. There's an approval process. You can't just go do it. So you make your submission, they approve it, then you can go, you know, sell it. With the 506B or 506C, we don't ask for permission. We just follow the guidelines. We do the disclosure documents, but nobody's overlooking us at the SEC, at least when we sell it. Now, if something goes wrong, you know, they'll audit and they'll look at the docs to make sure that they're compliant. But it's not like I have to ask permission from the SEC to do a 506B or a 506C or any of these other exemptions.
Gotcha. So if time was of the essence, 506CB is kind of the way to go. If, hey, this is a long runway ahead of us, maybe the Reg A is better because the SEC takes 18 months, so be it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it doesn't take, it's not a full registration. So it's not going to take 18 months, but a Reg A typically takes about 6 to 9 months. And so if you're in contract to, you know, buy a building, you don't have, you know, have 6 to 9 months, right?
Exactly.
So that's why it's not used very much there. It primarily gets used when you do a fund. So if you're going to go raise $50 million and it's a blind pool and or whatever it is, but there's no timeline. You're not like you've got to close in 90 days, but you still raise the money first, then go find properties. Then it starts to become, make sense. And the reason it starts to become sense, if you can put up with the 6 to 9 month, you know, registration process.
Sure.
If you can put up with the additional cost, because it's probably 6, 7, 8, not 10, but 6 times more expensive than doing the other ones, because you're dealing with lawyers and you're going back and forth. There's a lot of extra work. If you can deal with those two negatives and the compliance, because it's not, you think of a public company, you got the quarterly filing, the quarterly report, not as onerous, but they're there. So there's a compliance cost and a compliance nightmare there. If you can get around all those, then the beauty of Reg A is that you can advertise and you can take non-accredited investors. There's some limitations on how much you can take from them, but advertise and accept non-accredited investors, which is why it's appealing. But again, the time is maybe not a big deal. You're 6 to 9 months. Hey, I want to put together a fund. I can wait 9 months. But the cost, I mean, it's probably going to cost you 75, 80 grand to put one of those together. And then whatever the ongoing costs of just complying with your, you know, quarterly report, semi-annual report, your exit reports, your intro report, like all these crazy report, your audited financials, all this kind of stuff.
Sure.
But if cost is not prohibitive for you, that's why you usually see Reg A's at 50, 75 million, because you might as well max it out spending so much money.
Gotcha. Okay. So with that being said, and, you know, again, I haven't looked through all the, you know, fine print stuff they send, but you had mentioned with where you can advertise and accept non-accredited investors with this Reg A. Is that where, you know, like some platforms, like, you know, I'll just throw like Ground Floor, which, you know, kind of like a lending platform, or like peer-to-peer, Realty Mogul, Fundrise, for instance, where anyone with even like $100 could invest in. And, you know, I'm not accredited and I invest in them. Are those then examples of Reg A, or are they outside because, well, that's technically not a security per se?
No, the first one, I'm not, the peer-to-peer lending may have other regular. I'm not too familiar with that one, but yeah, Fundrise, okay. Realty Mogul, those, well, actually Realty Mogul might just be a 506C, but anytime you see, you know, advertising coupled with non-accredited investors, and usually if it's $100, you're going to have non-accredited.
Then right. Those are
Reg A. And I know Fundrise does Reg A. Gotcha. Realty Mogul, I think, may just do 506C. And again, or they may do both. Maybe like, hey, yeah, this one is accredited only, so it's a 506C. This one is a Reg A, so we're going to allow non-accredited.
Yeah, I know. And now that I say that, Realty Mogul, I think, has a couple of different funds. Like the one I'm invested in, you don't have to be, or was a sophisticated investor or something like that. There's a couple funds that are specifically 506C that I don't invest in. So yeah, I think they do both. Yeah. So.
And there's another one, which not too many people use, except maybe on the crypto world or the tokenization world, which is becoming a little bit more popular, is there's a regulated crowdfunding, which is a Reg CF, which also allows you to kind of advertise, but you got to go through a registered portal. You can't just do it on your own website. And you're limited to $1 million. I mean, there's some issues with that as well. But yeah, there's all these exemptions. But again, just going back, all you're doing is you don't want to register, right?
Sure.
That's just crazy. So what exemption are we going to rely on? And that's usually what you're having a discussion with your attorney is like, which one shall I rely on? And I'm going to be like, well, what do you want to do? Do you want to advertise? Do you not want to advertise? Do you want to take accredited? Do you not want to take accredited?
Okay.
I want to do both. Okay, well, great. Then let's do maybe a Reg A, a Reg CF. You know, how much do you want to raise? You know, 30 million. Well, Reg CF's not going to work, so it looks like a Reg A. Are you willing to wait 9 months and spend 80 grand? No. Okay. Well, then you're, you know, that's what we're doing. So just from your audience's perspective, if you're syndicating or you're a passive investor and you're just wondering, why can't I invest in a particular deal?
Or
why is it that I can invest in one or not the other? Or, hey, I'm seeing stuff posted on social media, I thought that was illegal.
It
just depends on the exemption that is being selected and making sure that you're complying with those rules.
This show is brought to you today by Lightbulb Podcasting. Are you a busy professional that needs to get more time back in their schedule? If you are a podcaster like me, you have enough on your plate. Why not outsource your podcast production? From editing, show notes, keywords, scheduling, volume balancing and editing, and creating audiograms, podcast production is another job in and of itself. That's why I use Lightbulb Podcasting. Get phenomenal support at an affordable price while you concentrate on growing your brand. Go to www.lightbulbpodcasting.com today to schedule an introductory call. Put your content in the spotlight. Gotcha. So, and maybe we can just touch on that last thing, and you know, non-legalese, like high level overview. What is the definition of a quote security as far as the SEC is concerned? I know people are familiar with, you know, I buy stock in Boeing or whatever. Well, obviously that's a security, but what is the, you know, definition per se for an SEC ruling?
Yeah. So the English version of this, because there's a Howey test, which is where this comes from. That's just a bunch of legalese. Anytime you take money from passive investors where the returns are generated by your efforts, meaning you're doing all the work and somebody's just writing a check and going home, that's a security. And it doesn't matter what the structure it is, doesn't matter if it's a note, whether it's an LLC, an LP, a profit sharing agreement, a TIC agreement, a safe contract, a high five, it doesn't matter. Right.
Gotcha.
If you're the one doing all the work and somebody's just writing you a check, essentially being passive, even if it's one person, that would be a security.
Okay. Gotcha. So, and now, Mauricio, you have mentioned, I think it was on a YouTube video or maybe a Facebook Live or something. This is quite a few months back. I know, like you said, time flies when you're having fun. But as far as, you know, finding out if you're accredited, not accredited, you know, I think high level, it's still, you know, I'm just going off of an individual, it's $200,000 of income per year, last 2 years. Seems like it's going to be that's going forward now, like you just won the lottery 1 year or something, and or $1 million net worth, with the exception of your primary residence, or, you know, that's subtracted from it. Are there any other ways to get accredited, or are there new changes coming for 2023 of like, hey, this is a, you know, fill out this questionnaire and you become accredited or something?
Yeah, unfortunately, not that easy. They're looking into, in fact, they passed a rule that they were going to start certifying people so that the net worth and the income requirement was no longer, because the argument's been going on for, what is it now, 40 years since it came out in 1982, that, you know, maybe the income and net worth or the financial wherewithal may not be the best or the only way to figure out if somebody should be allowed to invest or whether they're suitable and all that stuff. Because we all know those people who are super smart, you know, smartest person in the room, and they're just not accredited. And then we know billionaires who are the dumbest people in the world. So sometimes, you know, financial wherewithal isn't the right way. And so these acknowledge that. They've acknowledged that. And they basically came out with a rule a couple of years ago now at the end of, it's almost 2 years now, in December of 2020, that they're going to start doing some kind of a certification program where people can go to a certified, you know, school or course or whatever. We don't know what it looks like, but whatever that certification program looks like, pass an exam, and then you're going to be considered accredited.
Okay.
It's been 2 years now. It hasn't happened yet in terms of the programs to come out. So right now, if you wanted to do that, there's nobody that's authorized to give you that exam.
Gotcha.
The only people who right off the bat got qualified under that rule were all the investment advisors, because they figured, hey, these guys have already taken a Series 7 or a Series 82 or a Series 65. All those people have already, you know, gone through the exam or studied for the exam and passed that exam. And so if those people are in good standing with their state, then those people would automatically become accredited investors, even if they were a brand new broker making $100,000 a year. But hey, I have a Series 7. You're going to be accredited, because that's what they got in the door right away. But we're still waiting on the other stuff. And the reason that we're waiting is because, you know, like everything else, the SEC is it's a branch of the government. There's a political back and forth. There's some conservative, there's more some liberal, depends on who the administration is, all that fun stuff. But what the liberal side of the SEC, and I'm not getting political here, but they said, hey, look, we're okay with expanding the definition of the accredited investor, the certification program. But I also, they wanted to sort of pair that, I think, with an increase in that limit that you just mentioned. So right now the limit's $1 million, excluding your primary residence.
Sure.
But there's rumors, there's talks, there's whatever you want to call it, that number's going to go up. There was an article that said 10 million. I think that was a misread article. but I would say 3 million is, you know, maybe it ends up being 2, or, you know, whatever the compromise ends up being. But if you just adjust for inflation from 1982, $1 million in 1982 is about 3 million. It's like 2.8, 2.9.
Yeah.
So I could see them increasing it to 2.75 or 3 or 2.5. And then it would make sense, because on the one hand, they're making it harder for you to automatically qualify as an accredited investor. But on the other hand, you've got the option to go a certification route. So I'm thinking, and this is just pure, I don't have an inside scoop at the SEC. I'm not best friends with the Commissioner Geisler or anything like that. But my hunch tells me that when they come out with that, it's going to be around the same time that they'll announce that, hey, here's a couple of certification programs, but also here is the increase, the new definition. It's not $1 million anymore. It's 2.5 or 2 or 3 or 5 or whatever the number is. And whatever the challenging thing, I've actually had this thought experiment. I don't know what the number would be on income, right? Because income, you know, I mean, if you triple the income and you go from $200,000 to $600,000.
Yeah.
Well, now you're in like the top 1%. I mean, the top 1% earns 420 or 450 or something. So
yeah.
I don't know what the income would go up, but the net worth, I think is going to go, or maybe they just keep the income as it is. It's still 200, 300. But if you're trying to qualify on net worth, because everybody has all these assets, and all these assets have been, insert my opinion here, you know, inflated.
Yeah.
You've got a lot of people on the net worth side, and that number is, I think, is going to get inflated as well.
Exactly. So, and you kind of mentioned that. Maybe I could just put this to bed, because I have heard this both ways. When you mentioned, you know, I'll just throw out round numbers here. Say a couple has a $1.2 million net worth, and their house value is $250,000, $250,000. So subtract it out, they come to $950,000. Okay, sorry, you don't qualify. Is it the value of your home, or is it the like net equity of your home?
It's a net worth. So it's assets minus liability. So it's your equity, right? If you have a $1 million home, but you've got a $500,000 loan on it, well, that's going to count $500,000.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Well, I'm sorry. You're excluding it. So you actually don't get, if it's a personal residence, I thought you were talking about your assets.
Yeah, sorry. Personal residence. My bad.
If you have a property, then that's how you calculate. It's like if I own a commercial property or a single or a rental, and it's worth $1 million, but I've got a $500,000 loan in it, then it counts $500,000. Mm-hmm. But if it's your personal residence, it just doesn't count.
Gotcha. Okay. Whether it's paid off or
you have to exclude it from that. So you're looking at all your other assets, right?
Gotcha. Accounts,
properties, stocks, whatever you have, minus all your liabilities, because it's a net worth requirement. It's not an asset requirement. So that if there's another house, it's going to be minus the mortgage. And if you've got, you know, personal loans, if you've got student loan, you know, if you've got student loans, like all that, it's assets minus liabilities to get your net worth. And without counting your primary residence, do you have a million? Does you, you don't have to do with your spouse, it's really a household. Like, do you have
sure. a property? Okay. No, it makes sense. So, you know, just hypothetical, and maybe this has happened, or maybe there was a case study per se. As far as the regulations, let's just say, you know, John Rickarn, I get a letter signed by my CPA says, yep, John is an accredited investor. Yep, here's his assets, yada, yada. But, you know, whether either by error or outright fraud, I, you know, inflated some intangible asset, or I said, yep, this single family home is worth $250,000 or something like that. And once that's adjusted, then I'm no longer an accredited investor, but I've already invested in a 506c fund or syndication. If that were to happen, you know, just hypothetically, does the SEC, you know, tell you to dissolve your investment, or what all happens from that standpoint?
Well, there's three parties, right? There's the syndicator who's raising the money.
Sure.
Right. What's their liability or exposure? Then there's the past investor who presumably lied or inflated or whatever. What's their exposure? And then there's the CPA, like what's their exposure? So let's go through all of them. The CPA has enough, if you're going to do the CPA route, and a lot of CPAs either don't want to do it, or their insurance counsel says don't do it or whatever. Yeah. But the reason we allow CPAs to give you the letter, and attorneys and broker-dealers or investment broker-dealers, not investment, but broker-dealers, is because they're licensed, right? So they're obviously not going to fake something or just sign it.
Right.
Their license is at risk, right? And that's the problem, right? So it's very difficult. But if they sign the right documentation and the right letter, they just have to take reasonable steps. So reasonable steps, it's a reasonable person standard. Would a reasonable CPA do what they did? And if they're relying on your filed tax returns, right? That's what they're basing their letter, then they're going to be fine. That's the reasonable, they complied with their reasonable standard. The syndication okay. is the same way. The syndicator has an obligation to take reasonable steps to verify that you are an accredited investor, and they can rely on a properly drafted CPA letter. So if I get a CPA okay. verification letter that says, hey, I'm the CPA, I've taken reasonable steps to verify, and this person's accredited, then I, as a syndicator, I'm good.
Gotcha.
Now, from a passive investor standpoint, most of that information is going to be from your tax return. So if you've been inflating and cheating, and then you've got fraud problems, you've got tax fraud issues, or, you know, that part,
sure.
I mean, you just got basic fraud, right? I mean, if you fraudulently provided if anybody else is going to get into trouble, they're going to come after you for fraudulently providing them fraud information or negligent, whatever, the reckless or negligent, whatever. There's different, look, under the law,
sure.
not everything is up to, you could do something fraudulent, you could do something intentional, you can do something that's reckless, and or you can just do something that negligent. A negligent would be still a violation, but it's like, look, you just didn't act reasonably. It wasn't your fault. You didn't do it on purpose, but you just didn't know. And that's not an excuse, because you're supposed to act as a reasonable, prudent person would, and a reasonable prudent person would not have done it. So, okay. So the problem with the CPA, and that's coming up more and more and more and more, is that especially the larger firms, they're actually been instructed not to sign the letters that we provide them because of the language that's in there. I mean, they're basically okay. We're relying on their representation, and they're not comfortable with it. So the way it looks, this has gotten so out of hand almost. It's like, look, there are many, many, many verification companies out there that will verify the investors for you for like $60, if not okay. less. So there's no excuse to not just go, you're raising $1 million bucks or $10 million. Just put in a couple grand in your not even that much. I mean, if you have 10 investors, it's $600.
Okay. Right?
Like, there's no excuse not to use a third party verification company, and then you have nothing to worry about. Now, that all that liability is going to be on them. Like, why would you keep that risk on your books when you could outsource that risk to that third party verification company for $60? It just makes no sense. And so if the CPA, if you can send your CPA a DocuSign letter and they'll sign it because they're a single CPA and they just want to keep your yep. business and they don't care and they sign it, great. But if they give you pushback, great. Just go with the verification company, because that'll be an attorney. The attorney will actually review the okay. docs, and then you'll get a letter from the attorney. And that's what you're relying on as a syndicator. You've eliminated okay. the CPA from the equation. And again, the company, the attorney has to just take reasonable steps. So if you're committing fraud on me, you know, was it reasonable that sure. I should have figured that out? So it's gotcha. Mostly going to be on the passive method of committing the fraud.
Gotcha. So it could be, you know, different levels. You know, I outright lie on an asset statement or whatever, or I'm just careless or reckless. Like, well, I just went off of Zillow's estimates for all my rental properties, and they happen to be, you know, $150,000 above
something. Yeah, I don't think taking, you know, I don't think, well, a CPA is not going to take a Zillow.
Right.
And a syndicator is not going to, I don't think a Zillow pricing would be a reasonable step to verify, right? You want to at least have, you're not going to get an appraisal because that's crazy, but I would get a broker price opinion. It becomes challenging. I mean, there's a compliance nonsense, right? You got to, if you've got 20 properties, you got to do broker price opinions that at least get up to enough assets that you can then, you know, offset your liability. So you come up to $1 million.
Yeah. So makes sense. All right. Well, as we're wrapping this up, Mauricio, and again, thank you for your time and educating my listeners on this as well as myself. I've learned a few things. Yeah. If anyone out there listening, you know, is interested in learning more, maybe, you know, is an investor that wants to start raising money, wants to look at, you know, starting a fund, investing a fund, whatever, what's the best way to reach out to you and your firm?
You mentioned it earlier. We do a live weekly Zoom live. Like I literally pick a topic. When we've talked to all these topics we've talked about today, we've covered on the live. And then it's live. So it's an open Q&A. So I do a little presentation. Sometimes I have a guest, but then you ask me questions about the topic and then you can ask me questions about whatever you want. So we do those every Tuesday at 4:30 Pacific. And you can sign up at mauricioraul.com/live, mauricioraul.com/live. And then a lot of that or all of those end up going on the YouTube channel, which is just mauricioraul.com/YouTube. And you can see all of them are archived over there. And that's probably a good place to start. I'm not that hard to find.
Sure. Yep. Yeah. Neither am I. There's only 3 Rick Kearns in the world. So I just say, you know, Google me. So, all right. Well, I appreciate your time, Mauricio. And thanks for all this info. And hope all my listeners out there among the Nexus got some tidbits from this as well.
I appreciate you having me, John. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening. Be sure to share, rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. For more updates, check out www.wealthandfreedomnexus.com. Remember, nothing on this show should be considered tax, legal, investment, or professional advice. This show is produced solely for educational and informational purposes. Please consult an appropriate and licensed tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for specific advice for your situation. For distribution or publication rights or media interviews, please contact the host.